This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. It's good to be back together with this truly amazing teaching. I want to begin by thanking Doug and Nico for their great zeal, the fourth paramita, in putting this all together and keeping it all together for all of us, and to Doug for being so inclusive. And I'd like to also thank all the Jikoji residents who really, I feel, in this time, keep it all together for all of us. We are so supported by seeing you and knowing that you are there even when we can't see you. And this, with this Zoom room, we can be together in our heart minds, even though we're not literal physical bodies together, but our heart minds are here. And I want to also thank everyone who spoke this morning. We touched on so many themes, or you all brought up so many themes in our discussion that were related to this particular book and also practice. So much insight and heart and humility. And together, and it's why we gather in Sangha, so that we can hear from each other, so that we can grow together. Each other. Talked about the practices in this book and metta practice and what deep knowledge is, which was in one of the gathas in this chapter. And we talked about people brought up recognizing interconnection and equanimity and joy. So all these wonderful things brought up turning to what's difficult and turning to what's wholesome. And we also talked about language and what is beyond language. And I will return to that. Mado mentioned that, and that's one thing that really has resonated with me in this book. And in general, as it's a koan, I return to again and again. So I'd like to say one final thank you, because gratitude, like love and like questions, is endless. There can never be too much. There can never be too many. So I would like to thank Chuck yesterday for sharing his reflections on the first part of the book. I found them quite beautiful and very energizing. And he began with poetry, and I'll begin there too. Like Paula, I write poetry. But I'm going to give a disclaimer, first of all, because this is a talk, that I don't know the Flower Garland Sutra well. I have studied it, read it with my teacher, Angie, a large portion of it, the last portion. Quite an astounding piece. I said to the Floating Zendo this week, Leslie reminded me, like the Industrial Light Magic Show, only well beyond that, well beyond anything that CIG folks can do. So the disclaimer is that I'm not really, well versed in Huayan. I have read a little bit about that too and studied it a bit, but only not in any systematic or serious way. So what really resonates with me about the Flower Garland Sutra, which I love that translation because it's nothing like industrial light magic. It's what's all around us. It's nature and our nature. It surrounds us. This Dharma, we are inextricable from the flower garlands. When we want to realize that. And clearly, we're all realizing that because we're all here. But it's not only a work of art, but it's also a compendium of Buddhist teaching from the very earliest teachings. And that's particularly comes through in Book 11 to me. And it's also an incredible work of philosophy. So it's truly a remarkable writing, language that we treasure, that we have available to us to engage with. And now it just occurs to me, I should also give thanks to Thomas Cleary, whose work is, I respect so much. He's done so much to bring Buddhist and other Asian literatures to us. So a poem. A hand moves and the fire's whirling takes different shapes. All things change when we do. The first word, ah, blossoms into all others. Each of them is true. That's from who was the founder of Shingon, not directly related to the Huayan school, but they were all a little closer in those days, according to the reading I've done. And Kukai was, like Dogen, a brilliant teacher, poet, writer. He founded the Shingon school, like Dogen founded the Zen school, so Japanese Zen school. So he comes to mind because of this, for two reasons: the question of language. He has that beautiful, the first word, ah, blossoms into all others. So there's no problem with language. Each of them is true. And yet language is also kind of tricky. We discussed that some yesterday too, because language is, of course, a place where we meet. And other creatures have their languages too, which in a few people are just beginning to look into and understand. I remember decades ago and being in Canada on a boat that was recording, one of the first to record sonar from whales in the Straits of San Juan de la Fuca. So people are looking into this, but it's still a huge mystery, language. We have our form, and it's how we touch each other in really significant ways. And yet it's so vast, it has so many possibilities, endless really, but they can go in the direction of wisdom or in the direction of suffering. So that's why it's a real koan for us, I think. So this book because it's in gathas is one reason that came, really resonated with me, touched me. It's in a poetic form largely. So, and the other thing is it's entitled Purifying Practice. So in Zen, we have our Zazen practice, Shikantaza, which in one sense contains everything, and yet in another sense, Dogen left us quite an amazing record of what needed to be spoken from his perspective in the Shogogenzo. So there's still a place for words. Often our minds are filled with words when we sit down in this Shikantaza position. And words are very seductive. We can get caught up in believing them. And we often do. So that's a real koan of how to be with this, how to be with language, our own language that we've internalized perhaps so much we don't even know the stories we're telling ourselves and believing about ourselves or about others. And these purifying practices that are outlined in, we're given many examples of in Book 11, really help us to see into and to see clearly when those moments are ripe for us, when the causes and conditions are where we can see clearly. They really help us to untangle some maybe karmic knots or some puzzles in our mind or some places we're stuck. So one example that I can very, I find very important for my own practice is the full moon precepts through in the Phoenix Cloud lineage, at least, and the one that I know is the one Angie taught, and which was Coben's. So those every full moon, they are a way of languaging, of expressing in a down to earth way of in our lives now as we're living them. Acknowledging who we are and accepting that and finding our way to what's deeper, what Meido brought up today, what's below the language. So all my ancient wrongdoings arising from beginningless greed, hatred and delusion based on body, mind, and speech. Speech is specifically called out here, as it is in the Four Noble Truths. Wise speech, right speech. I fully avow these. Sometimes these full moon precepts are called repentances or renewals. I like to call them acknowledgments, just acknowledging how much we have within us, like Michael did this morning with his Trump supporting neighbors and with Trump himself. We all have that within us. And then we have all the treasures of Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha to help us and support us. So we acknowledge those, we return to those in the precepts. So, and then after returning, we return to our ground of practice again, avowing more deeply to embrace and sustain right action embrace and sustain every good, embrace and sustain all beings. So I find that a very helpful example of how language can help us. And any one of the many gathas in here could also bring us to a place that we each in our own heart minds find would be helpful. So we also spoke about metta in a kind of a general way. It's not such a part of Zen practice, except that it has been and is being perhaps folded in somewhat by the nature of Buddhism coming to the West. I find having practiced a number of years in insight Vipassana tradition and in Zen, and even some in Tibetan, there are ways which they are all part of Buddhist practice. They all come from Buddha's teaching. But how their helpful practices are becoming a little more accessible each to the other. So metta is actually has four parts, which we didn't discuss in detail, but I would like to bring them in because they were kind of alluded to. Aisha brought in one, equanimity. So metta itself, it's used as a general term, but the first practice, metta itself, is great friendliness. That's usually translated loving kindness. I like great friendliness because it doesn't have quite as much background with loving and with kindness and sort of just being friendly, even simple friendliness. When we someone that is of the heart, which all these practices are from the heart in the early teachings, being friendly. And then we can often from that kindness arises, even loving feelings. And the next one is karuna, which is compassion, to meet the suffering of beings. That too from the heart. And then joy, which Pamela mentioned this morning, appreciative joy of others, for others, even for ourselves. Joy. And then upeka, equanimity. So these are called the Brahmaviharas, the divine abodes, where we can abide. And no matter how they might come to you or if they do, it's always a feeling of the heart. So I brought a lot of poems and a couple of other things, so I'm bringing things in here and there. One thing we talk about, which we usually do in any Buddhist tradition because it's so central, it's that big koan, okay, it all starts with recognizing suffering. So there's no end to suffering, but there's also no end to the compassion to meet it. And that's what we, I think, really need to keep in mind. And that's what our practice together does for us, our dedication to these times of year, our dedication to our forebears, the ancients who really engaged with these things as we are endeavoring to do. So there's no end to suffering and no end to meeting the suffering. There's no end to compassion that can meet the suffering. In the Dhammapada, the earliest verses, in one of the very early collections, sort of almost, well, before the Pali Canon, really, the Dhammapada begins with, there is, and it's supposedly, and it's a poem, it's supposedly the Buddha's words, attributed always to Buddha, Shakyamuni Buddha. Love alone conquers hatred. Hatred never ceases without love. There's no end to love either. This is a law, ancient and exhaustible. This is the law. So I think we've connected with that. Somehow that has touched that place that's through language, but beyond language, that we know within ourselves, this is the law. Regardless of what we see around us, regardless of the state of our world, the state of our lives with their complexities, their karmic knots, their unskillfulnesses, they also contain that love that we recognize. So the equanimity, that's that I, in Zazen, that's like the strong back. That's like the upright and the posture. That's what centers us and keeps us grounded and able to meet and see what arises. And the compassion is the soft chest, the soft open heart, not like this, but like this. And compassion is heartening to me. It's the humility, which is the chin slightly down. It's not like, I know and here's my statement. It's listening to what people have to say, what others are saying to us, what Dogen's beautiful words, what the wind is saying to us, what the birds are saying to us. Listening to what the grasses are saying, the mountains. So in times when it's difficult to meet things, what can we call on? What are our resources? This is what we're doing with the Flower Garland Sutra. It's another resource for us. Our vows. Vows are an incredible resource. As Emily brought in the precepts and the paramitas. They're all kinds of vows. They all call us to engage and strengthen us, enliven us, bring us joy even. So metta is also boundless, and the metta practices, or any kind of compassion arising practice, and it's, you could also say from the Dhammapada that love is kind of a fuel for our journey, for our continuing on. When we touch that heart, our heart mind of love, because it's all connected. It comes through in our speech, in our presence, in our demeanor. So, language. I'd like to read some poems now. A poem, if you can find that poem.
I do with them.
Let me see what I brought those papers. Well, maybe I left that poem upstairs. My office. Oh no, here it is. So, in relation to our acknowledging where we are, and in language, acknowledging who we are, like the full moon precepts. This is a poem by Jane Hirschfield from her latest book called Ledger. Ledger. It's kind of an accounting of where Jane is, I guess. And the poem is called My Debt. Like all who believe in the senses, I was an accountant, copyist, statistician, not registrar, witness, permitted to touch the leaf of a thistle, the trembling work of a spider, to ponder Hubble's recordings. It did not matter if I believed in the party of the particle or the wave, as I carried no weapon. It did not matter if I believed. I weighed ashes, actions, cities that glittered like rubies on the scales I was given, calibrated in units of fear and amazement. I wrote the word it. I entered the debt that is owed to the real. Forgive, spine-covered leaf, soft-bodied spider, octopus lifting one curious tentacle back toward the hand of the diver. That in such black ink, I set down your flammable colors. So Jane is writing largely in this book of the climate crisis that this planet is experiencing. You know, she alludes to the vanishing of species and the fragility and preciousness, and acknowledges her debt to, in her way, in a way she can. And of course, we each have to find our ways. But we can meet whatever is arising, difficult as it might be in our own self, or even these large events, which can be overwhelming. I often feel like inadequate, and then I have to work with that. But Chuck also brought in Claudia Rankine and the whole, and thereby, and others too, Angela Kyodo Williams, the issue of racism. These difficult issues, which actually are being addressed by language and on the scale of humanity where we are now, can only really be addressed by language. The alternative is pretty unthinkable, although people do think about war. So meeting all that, meeting that. some more poems. This one is, this little section is about the vastness, you know, the emptiness and us, and us. It's from Crow with No Mouth by EQ. Pleasure, pain are equal in a clear heart. No mountain hides the moon. This boat is and is not. When it sinks, both disappear. Is and is not. When it sinks, both disappear. I'm pure shame. What I do and what I say are never the same. He has a really great sense of humor, which is also something maybe not super forward in Book 11, but as part of Buddhist teaching, in Zen particularly. And finally, you can't be anyone but you. Therefore, you are that other one you love. You can't be anyone but you. Therefore, you are that other one you love. So, and since these are poetry, a little background from the Chinese. Early on, Chuck also mentioned, brought in a beautiful poem by Sam Hamill. And I'm going to read a translation of his of Lu Qi's Wen Fu, The Art of Writing, one of the earliest writings on writings extant at all, and on writing as far as Sam Hamill's research. So, surely facility language and charging of the word with energy are effects which can be achieved by various means. This may be easy to know, but it is difficult to put into practice. Each writer finds a new entrance into the mystery, and it is difficult to explain. Nonetheless, I have set down my thinking as clearly as I am able. So I read this as not only for writers, but for practitioners, to getting to that level of below the language. It's difficult to explain, but we keep trying. We keep putting our paramita of perseverance and energy and zeal into it, because we know we can touch something deeper. Although language is all a metaphor, kind of a poor way of doing it, but that's what we poor humans have. It's also a glory. It's that too. And then that mystery is in a beautiful book by David Hinton, who translates largely Chinese Buddhist poetry and also Taoism, and writes also beautiful poetry. But this book is called Existence, A Story. And he talks about that undifferentiated existence tissue that's below language. And he cites a name and he gives the character Dark Enigma that Lao Tzu, whom he's translated, uses. And this is the last, the end of the first poem, the last phrases of the first poem. In the Tao Te Ching. In perennial absence, you see mystery, and in perennial presence, you see appearance. though the two are one and the same, once they arise, they differ in name. One and the same, they're called the dark enigma. Dark enigma deep within dark enigma, gateway of all mystery. Dark enigma, goes on David Hinton, is a return to the consciousness prior to language. It is, in a word, the existence tissue here in the beginning, where we find a single whole, vast and deep, everywhere and everything. So I think we do have to allow that there is this mystery in whichever way we can, and that will be different at different times. I would like to end with Aitken Roshi and Gathas, because Gathas are a beautiful practice. And I also encourage anyone who has a turn of mind to write a Gatha, write Gathas. It's really a wonderful practice. And it doesn't have to be poetry and take a certain form, although this book by Aitken Roshi has a beautiful form. But it can just be even phrases that you remember, that stick with you, that you can just put together, write down, that call you back to that meditative state of mind, to that openness to whatever's arising, to that openness to whatever's arising. Here is a, at a Zendo meeting for business, I vow with all beings to drop my plan in the hopper and let the process evolve. Just very down to earth, Aitken Roshi. There's another one in here. Whenever I'm tempted to judge, I vow with all beings to remember we have two nostrils and the same implacable feet. When I turn into somebody nasty, I vow with all beings to reflect on how it all happened and uncover my long hidden tale. When I move to complain about others, I vow with all beings to remember that karma is endless and it's loving that leads to love. And finally, and I hope that this is appropriate. I really need to read this one a few times. When joining others for sharing, I vow with all beings to give my report on the weather without making a mess on the floor. So, thank you for your attention, and I very much look forward to hearing from you all.
Carolyn, this is Hogan. Can you hear?
Hogan, I can hear you. Good to see you, Hogan.
Thank you. It's lovely to be with you and with everyone. Just simply the gathas that you read at the end, thank you for those and for the thoughts that came beforehand. And the gatha that you had for judging, I had a technical issue right as you introduced it, and I couldn't hear a single word, but myself, I was like, ooh, I need to hear this. So please, could you reread that, please?
Okay. Yeah. Let's see, where did I mark it? I have so many marks in this book. Get back to it. Oh, here it is. Yeah. Whenever I'm tempted to judge, I vow with all beings to remember we both have two nostrils and the same implacable fate.
Thank you. Thank you.
Doug.
Yes. In book 10, in the, I think the eighth or ninth section near the end of it, Tom Tolin pointed out that it included the Paramitas, and it also includes the Brahma Viharas. And it starts with, for the stingy, one praises generosity. And then it ends with, for the devious, one praises equanimity. Now, equanimity, I wanted to get your take on it because it is, it seems very settled and broad. And yet, in exploring that nut of approaching deviousness, one praises equanimity, it seems that persistence is also part of equanimity. Resoluteness, uprightness, thoroughness. You know, there are a lot of aspects that might be part of equanimity. And I'm just wondering, when it comes to, for example, how we in our culture deal with issues between people, you know, we have laws. And in a way, I'm just wondering if maybe you see laws as a way of establishing a base where equanimity can thrive.
Thank you, Doug. Equanimity is really a huge quality. It's really big, and it's considered the, at least that's what I remember from Insight Vipassana practice. It is talked about as the last, because it's what you're kind of, you know, like understanding the emptiness, understanding what it is to be equanimous. And you've listed several of the really important factors of it, but there are more, and there's also stability. So all of those together are kind of stability. So that's the grounding of zazen, and you know, keeping presence of mind. When in an earthquake or when things go fires, I mean, or Thich Nhat Hanh has a story decades ago about boats out of Vietnam. You know, those people who kept the boat together with completely overcrowded situations and no water and no food and out 50 days and just keeping calm. Calmness is also an enlightenment factor. And so all of those are important. As laws, it's interesting you bring that up, because of course the Buddha had to kind of start laying down the laws, because people were really unaware. I didn't speak so much about awareness, but this chapter to me is about the Satipatthana Sutta. It's about the mindfulness, awareness, keep bringing awareness back, keep bringing awareness of one's actions, one's speech, one's heart, one's body back. But people are not always aware. And so then when the monks weren't aware and started doing things that weren't in accord with the noble truths, then they built up a kind of a code, the monastic code, the Vinaya, as big almost as some of the sutta sections. So laws do have a place, I believe, but then there's a tendency to sort of hold on to the laws. And also deviousness, that's very interesting, that choice of language, deviousness and equanimity together. Because the laws can be manipulated. They can be made practiced in devious ways. You know? It's like endless argumentation, and we are very clever beings. So I think there is a place, and laws can be changed, and you can look at the historical general record of humankind, and at least as far as I know it, and say that changing laws in certain ways has brought more of humankind to an awareness of harm and suffering and behavior. But they certainly aren't, I certainly wouldn't want to have them as my only method, my only tool, because they're just too human. And there are plenty of laws, even in our own country, that were actually, well, you know, like the Three-Fifths Amendment, you know, I mean, there are plenty of laws that were actually induced, so it caused generational trauma, which we're all still feeling right now. So that would be what I could say. I don't know if that's...
One of the things about this practice that in where is accountability in this and I guess that's why I'm looking here. We hold ourselves accountable, hopefully, but sometimes we have to hold others accountable too. And when the general Buddhist approach is to get over it, or let it go, or just give love, there are times where there has to be a resolute approach that actually results in a decision that is helpful for the person that may be exhibiting some of these qualities. I guess what I wanted to do was dig deeper into some of these so that as a Buddhist involved in action, that there, it's not always, it really doesn't matter, so let's just get over it. That somebody killed somebody else, well, you know, I'm sorry. And may all beings be blessed, isn't enough. And so if we're a practice that actually is in accord with our society in ways, that's why I bring up laws. You know, laws, you point out, can be very held onto or manipulated, deviously used as well. And yet they give a chance, as Chuck pointed out yesterday, for those who are suffering to be heard. Maybe that's one way for a forum to be heard. So I'm just, that's what I'm struggling with Buddhist action and making it also comply with these wonderful gifts we have of the Paramitas and the Brahmaviharas?
I guess I don't see that there's a particular dissonance, but because I do believe the ground is love, where does that come from to change the laws? And also, I am not hearing those Buddhists. I am hearing Buddhists who are Zen peacemakers, who are socially engaged. And I actually hear so that I hear what you say, that we can't turn away. There are ways within the practice, and in fact, even in Book 11, these practices are turning toward they are turning toward, even although they're impersonal and the wishing, but we do need to take it into action. Absolutely. We do. There are ways to act. And we have to be able to listen and hear the suffering, which Chuck kind of brought up too, quoting from a book with Angel Kyodo Williams, that we have to be able to listen and to be open to. We have to be open to change. I just don't see that there's a dissonance there. I mean, perhaps, but I will confess, it's one reason that I did not practice Buddhism for many years, because I felt it was a kind of a turn away from the world and the issues of the world, view of the world. But when I began to practice, I saw that no, actually it's a turning toward. So I think laws can be helpful. They have to be considered very carefully, though. And we do have to be strong and resolute, and whatever ways we can be encouraged to do that. But the ground of, it's the first verse of the Dhammapada. The ground of the law, ancient and inexhaustible, is love. So we have to be really clear in ourselves what our motives are, what our intentions are. Talk about laws. And also I agree historically that the trend that I see, the view that I see, is that laws have changed cultures, have changed situations. I also read an article recently, just a brief article about by a sociologist who is studying very recently, what causes change? What causes actually a social paradigm to shift? And it takes 25% of a given group. And that group, he studied groups from four, I think, up to 60 or 80. And if you just get enough people, and there were different interesting tipping points, when you had 20 people and when you had 40 people. But we do need to stand up, and we need to say this. And if we see, for example, I don't know who you're hearing, but if we need to see people say, well, I'm sorry. So I guess that's my response. So thank you for digging deeper. Digging deeper is always, there's always more. It's not over until the end. If it's not the end, it's not over.
Thank you.
Hi, Carolyn.
Go ahead.
So I remember after Doug said that, I remember Tetsugin, Bernie Glassman, the late Bernie Glassman, the story from him. I mean, there's many stories from him because he founded Zen Peacemakers Order. But, there's also this beautiful, the Gate of Sweet Nectar, Honey Manchalisa that he made. It's on YouTube that some Krishna Das made based on Bernie Glassman renamed the words of Gate of Sweet Nectar from Maizumi Roshi's lineage. It's beautiful. You can change it, see it on YouTube. It's beautiful. But he was driving on the freeway in LA after he's already been a Roshi. And he had this insight of like the great suffering that he was seeing all around. And he said that was his second enlightenment. And he rededicated his life to alleviating suffering. And that's when he went to like that bread making place I forgot in New York, in Yonkers, and he made that. And then he went to Rwanda and he set up this reconciliation. There's amazing stories of that. And then Native Americans, and then Auschwitz, or Auschwitz in Poland, and Birkenau, and street sitting and all that. I know Doug goes to prisons. You know, so that's just one thing. And then the other thing, you mentioned the word Shin. So, you know, it's a Shin, heart, mind. You know, Japanese heart, minds come from Chinese Shin.
Yes.
Same. And this Chinese person I know, because especially when I was younger and I still have this struggle between my heart and my mind. My mind wants something and my heart says something else. And I don't know what's heart, what's mind. Anyway, these are all abstractions anyway. But she told me that in Chinese, the mind, when they say the word Shin, the mind is contained within the heart. So it's unified. But your heart encloses your mind. So I take that analogy as an insight comes from your mind, maybe, but it's filtered through your heart. And it comes out differently into the world. Instead of dry, I had a friend who called wet Zen dry Zen. Instead of dry Zen, it becomes wet Zen. So anyway, and I just want to say one last thing. I remember Jero, when we were doing Tyson's emptiness presentations last time, Jero split a piece of paper. He drew a vertical line in the middle, I think, and he wrote this calligraphy on each half, and he said something, there's these two halves, and on the left half, he wrote the word without, and on the right hand, he wrote the word words. So first I thought, oh, he's saying emptiness is without words, but then I remembered Doug's teacher, Katagiri Roshi, has two books, Returning to Silence, and the second book is You Have to Say Something. So you return to silence, and from that place, you can say something to the world. So that's what, I don't know if that's what Jerome meant or not. Maybe I misinterpreted what he said. But anyway, that's what I wanted to say. Thank you.
Thank you for bringing that in. Yeah, that is what I meant to say. I thought I had a lot of things to say, but but I didn't want to leave a mess on the floor. So
my job normally. Sorry.
So one thing was to bring in a poet, because this isn't only Zen. This is human. This is human nature. We have our, you know, way of relating, which is wonderful, and it nourishes us deeply. It allows us to go forward, being our deepest human nature. But from a poet in the Western tradition of W.B. Yeats, speech after long silence, it is right. You know? So there's that dance of the silence and the speech. So thank you so much for bringing all these stories in, or background and context, really great for Bernie Glassman. There's a place, and there are people like Doug who go places and do things. And there are groups if you move to join those, and you can do things individually. You can do things without being particularly Zen about it, like, you know, writing letters for, that's what I did a lot of this year, this last period, to encourage people to vote, you know. So, thank you. Well, Doug, I think it's about time. A little more? Okay.
Hi. This is Trout. Hi.
Oh, Trout.
I'm not sure who said what because I've got it written down here. So, but I think I heard this isn't Zen. This is human nature. And what comes up for me is that anytime that we think that Zen is separated from human nature, that we're missing what Indra's net has to teach us. That Indra's net teaches us that it's all connected and we're all connected to each other. So if we're sitting Zazen, we're still in Indra's net, and there's this reflection of us to other people, to everyone else, including grass and mouse and lizard, and reflection of all of those other jewels back to us. And so I can't see a separation between Zen and human nature. It feels to me like my experience is that it's part of human nature, and that we keep learning from it. And as you said, I loved what you said. It's, you know, we're going to keep learning till the end. I'm not sure we don't even keep learning after the end or whatever that is, but I appreciate it. And I loved your ending by saying, I don't want to leave a mess on the floor. And then you just changed that and said, I hope I leave a mess on the floor, or whatever it is. But I think a mess on the floor is really helpful. And if we ever think we can get the floor completely cleaned, it doesn't work that way.
Well, thank you, Trout. I think that was kind of like an insight for me at a certain point when I went like, Buddha nature, human nature, what does that mean? And like, oh, but I didn't. So what about speech? And you said, oh, and then I changed that. And I did not realize I changed that to, I hope I leave a mess on the floor. But that's great. That reminds me of what Ikkyu said. He said, I have no shame. I never say the same thing twice. I don't keep consistent. So thank you.
And I want to say just also, thank you for bringing in Ikkyu. I think half of the reading I've been doing the last 3 months is Ikkyu. So it's just really wonderful reading Jim Harrison's stuff of Ikkyu too. Jim was a student of Koban, so it's wonderful to see that too. So thank you. Thank you for bringing in and poetry in general. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.